Monday to Friday, 2:30 to 4, it is the Blitz here on AM 1450 KATE. Mitch Widmeyer here with you. He hops on every week. We're always thankful and appreciative for his time. Arif Hassan is our guest this afternoon. Find his work at zonecoverage.com. You'll see the Vikings tab at the top of the page. Click on that, or find his work through the Daily Norseman as well. Thank you, as always, Arif. We'll get to the Vikings in a minute. I wanted to start with something else. Last night's game, Bengals-Steelers, it was brutal hit after brutal hit. I think obviously the Steelers win the game, but the number one takeaway headline is the concern for Ryan Shazier, who was taken off on a stretcher and taken to the University of Cincinnati Hospital after he had a collision in the first quarter. But I wanted to step aside even from that for a second. There were three occasions this week in Arif where I couldn't help but think, like, what if this was player A, B, or C instead? And one of them was last night. You had Juju Smith-Schuster, who just laid out Vontaze Burfict on a peelback block, helmet to helmet, stood over him as Burfict just laid on the ground. And my first thought, and maybe I'm in the wrong here, but my first thought, Arif, was if that was Vontaze Burfict and we switched the roles, he's getting ejected. He's banned for life. There's an angry mob forming, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the thing is, I actually don't think Juju's block was all that bad. I thought it looked really violent, but I think, Burfict was turning, he'd already turned towards the player in question and was moving towards him. And the issue is the helmet-to-helmet and the taunting and not the block itself. I thought that was actually, it looks bad because it looks bad, but I thought it was legal. The helmet-to-helmet and the taunting is the bigger problem to me, but I think that you're right that if you'd switched the players involved, you know, Vontaze Burfict would have been ejected, he would have gotten a suspension, I absolutely agree.
And there were two other occasions, and I just want to go down this path since I've opened up the can of worms on it anyways, from this weekend where it was like similar situations where I thought, man, what if this was this player ABC 123, and one of them was with Tom Brady, and I was laughing, seeing him on the sidelines just screaming relentlessly right in the face of Josh McDaniels, and just about everyone I saw that had a take on this unanimously was saying, oh, you know, it shows how much Tom Brady wants to win. He's a fiery leader. And my first thought, again, maybe I'm in the wrong, was what if that was Cam Newton doing the same thing? What if that was like Baker Mayfield at Oklahoma?
That's exactly what I was thinking. The first person I thought of was Baker Mayfield.
Why do we do this? Why do we do this? We praise Tom Brady, and I know for a fact, like you said, if that was Baker Mayfield or Cam Newton, they're getting shredded for doing the same thing that Tom Brady's getting praised for.
Right, yeah, and the thing is, like, we kind of did see Adrian Peterson do the same thing, that formed like a narrative that he's not fitting in New Orleans anymore, and it is a different context because he was playing poorly, and you know Brady obviously wasn't. Baker Mayfield. No one ever says, well, I shouldn't say no one, but most people don't say, he's just passionate about the game. it's the same thing.
The last one, and then I promise we will get to Vikings topics, it's from the same game. It's Gronk's hit. He had the cheap shot of the weekend taking out Tre'Davious White. He's been suspended for a game. I actually thought it might be more than a one-game suspension for Gronk, but he will be out next week. I don't know if he's appealing or not. No idea what that looks like. I have honestly seen people say, though, like, Gronk, that's Gronk. He's an idiot. He doesn't know any better. And my first thought with that hit was, imagine if that same hit happened, Arif, by any defender in the league on any team. The same exact hit happens, but instead on the receiving end, it's not Tre'Davious White, it's Tom Brady. What do you think the consequence is?
Oh, my God. 6 games, maybe. I thought Gronk should have been suspended for 2 games, and some players it makes sense to suspend them more, like Vontaze Burfict, because they've got a history and Gronk doesn't have a history, and it does seem, you know, uncharacteristic of him, but that doesn't mean you don't punish him like you would any first-time offender. Like, that ruins the whole point of a punishment system. He's an idiot. Maybe he doesn't know what he's doing. He sounded like he knew what he was doing. He is appealing, by the way, that they did indicate that he was appealing. But if he doesn't know what he's doing, what better way to teach someone how to know that than to give him the same suspension everyone else would get? That's ridiculous to me. You don't, like, grade on a curve.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Arif Hasan is our guest this afternoon. Find his work Zone Coverage or through the Daily Norseman. I won't vent anymore. Vikings are the topics from here on out. They had another impressive win, 14-9 over Atlanta on Sunday. This, to me, was the most impressive win of the season for Mike Zimmer's squad, even more so than the L.A. game. It was on the road against the defending NFC champ who had won three straight. We talked last week because I asked you, Arif, like, are the Falcons good again? Because they were 4-4. Everybody was burying them. It seemed they had turned a corner. They won three straight. The offense was clicking. Julio was coming off a mammoth game, like a mammoth game, and the Vikings just shut down that offense. And given all those circumstances that I just laid out on the road against a team that seemed to be figuring it out on offense and had won three straight, was this to you as well the most impressive win of the year?
I think so. Certainly, I think it's maybe the final game where we can say, yeah, they've been tested enough. We know this is a good team. Because, you know, I think before the game, the Vikings were like 5-1 against teams with winning records, so you can't say they haven't, you know, played some good opponents and come out ahead. But it always felt like there were caveats to be made, right? Because the Saints game, there's no way that that's the same Saints team anymore. We know that they're a better Saints team now. The Rams game, it always felt like, you know, Goff has always played, or the season had always played really poorly against good teams and really well against bad teams. So you could caveat kind of all of these games a little bit. In the Washington game, you know, maybe Keenum should have had four picks, you know, whatever, right? In this game, it really just felt like, okay, we've played seven opponents with winning records. We know this opponent is a good one. We don't have to caveat. You know, if we keep on making excuses, at this point we're just making excuses to make excuses. The Vikings are a good team. They beat good teams. And this is a really good example of that. So maybe some of that comes with the context of the previous games. We can build off of that experience. But, you know, some of this is this game. Like you said, they've got a really good offense that could only score 9 points. Some of it was that the offense kind of shot themselves in the foot. Don't need to sugarcoat it. Like, the Falcons kind of beat themselves a little bit, too. But also the Vikings did a pretty phenomenal job holding down, you know, players like Julio Jones and Devonta Freeman, even when, you know, some of their defensive players like Xavier Rhodes weren't having the best game. It's just a really solid team.
All right, you just brought up something I was going to ask you down the road, but I'll bring it up right now, and I'm not trying to be overbearing, I promise, but box score readers will see Julio had two catches for 24 yards on six targets and assume that Xavier Rhodes completely shut him down. I thought Xavier Rhodes was all right, and maybe I'm off here, but I thought, Arif, there were multiple chances for the Falcons where Julio beat Xavier, and either Matt Ryan didn't put the ball in a good place or didn't see Julio. I know Julio Jones had at least one drop as well. I thought there were opportunities where Julio Jones clearly had Xavier Rhodes beaten and the Vikings were able to escape out of harm's way.
I actually thought Xavier Rhodes had a poor game, not even an all right game. And that's fine to say. He's still a top 10 cornerback. He should go to the Pro Bowl. He's a great player. I don't want to extend this into a criticism of him overall, and I think maybe it's an indication that he was playing injured, which is fine. I think that you're right. He lost a lot of battles against Julio, and, you know, I know a lot of people will say, but it's Julio, you know, even the best cornerbacks are going to lose a lot of battles, and yeah, okay, that's true, but even if you compare Xavier Rhodes to himself, you know, he's done a much, much better job against Julio in his previous two matchups, against Calvin Johnson, against Antonio Brown this year, against Odell Beckham last year. It was his worst performance against a top-tier receiver in a long time, and so I don't want to, like, give him an excuse that it's Julio, because Julio did a really good job against him and, you know, dropped one pass that had nothing to do with Rhodes and didn't get targeted when he should have been targeted. And also, Rhodes wasn't even shadowing Julio all that much this game, and I think that's another indication that that injury was bothering him. You know, he was on Marvin Hall, and Marvin Hall got a 20-yard catch on him. He was on Mohamed Sanu, and Mohamed Sanu got a catch on him. He was targeted 8 times for 4 completions for 54 yards and benefited from 2 drops, where it really should have been. He allowed 75% of the passes in his way to hit the cornerback's hands without interfering with the cornerback, the receiver's hands without interfering with the receiver. And, you know, he struggled, I think. The rest of the team, I thought, did a really good job, and shutting down Julio was something that the rest of the team helped contributed to. I thought Harrison Smith and Andrew Sindeo both had lights-out standout games. And so, yeah, I mean, Julio's going to be better next, or Xavier's going to be better next week. It's not a problem, but it's okay to say that he had a bad game.
Always love having him on the program. Arif Hasan, our guest this afternoon. Find his work, zonecoverage.com. Click on the Vikings link at the top of the page. You referenced Case Keenum earlier. Did you ever think in the year 2017 you'd say confidently that Case Keenum would outplay Matt Ryan? Because it happened Sunday. You mentioned caveats before in reference to Vikings opponents and how the schedule has played out. There is the caveat that the Vikings defense, I think most would objectively look at it and say, is superior to that of the Falcons defense. But if you want to make a case for Keenum, you would say that Matt Ryan's got awesome weapons too. Julio Jones, Devonta Freeman was back, Tevin Coleman, Mohamed Sanu, Austin Hooper's having a good year. That Falcons O-line has been pretty dang good. So Keenum's got the weapons. He has the offensive line, but so does Matt Ryan. And I thought Keenum just thoroughly outplayed Matty Ice.
I think so, but I think I wasn't super impressed with Keenum's performance. Obviously, sort of the 13 for 13 in the second half, which was part of a 15 completion streak. Hard to argue against it. But I think it's actually a greater credit to Pat Shurmur, who took the Falcons' defensive line completely out of it. I think early on, the pressure was getting to Keenum, and that was a problem. I thought Keenum had some difficulty with accuracy and ball placement, especially early on. Before that final two-minute drive, which was completely meaningless, the Falcons were just kind of giving up completions just so that they could drain the clock, and it worked. He was averaging like 5 yards an attempt, and he had a 60% completion rate, and it was pretty poor. And I think Pat Shurmur adjusted really well by getting rid of the ball really quickly, making sure the defensive line could have no impact on the play, taking advantage of how good those skilled players are at getting yards after the catch, how poor the Falcons have been at tackling screens despite the amount of team speed they have, and how the scheme itself, the cover three that they run, really is open to outside and underneath passes because there's no defender there that can get there quickly enough. I think Keenum definitely executed, certainly in the second half. He definitely placed the ball better, certainly in the second half. And I think that he outplayed Matt Ryan because of the sort of the schematic things. But had Sarkisian been if it had been Kyle Shanahan instead of Sark, it would have been kind of interesting to see, sort of how they would have adjusted, because Sark has been a bit of a problem, I think, as an offensive coordinator, and they didn't adjust to how much pressure the Vikings were putting on Ryan. And Ryan looked really poor. We can say there were maybe three receiver drops in the game, but each drop, it felt like 50-50 on the receiver on Matt Ryan, because he kept on putting it really high and really not helping his receivers a lot. So, yeah, I think Keenum outplayed Matt Ryan, but I think a lot of it had to do with just the difference in talent in the offensive coordinators.
Speaking of Matt Ryan, as we look on the flip side with the Falcons offense, what was up with him? It was almost as if every time he dropped back, or if he was expecting pressure, and he was pressured at times. I don't believe he was sacked all afternoon, but the Vikings still got some pressure on him. But it seemed like to me every time he would drop back to pass, three-step drop, five-step drop, he was expecting pressure. I thought he was like fidgety, and he looked uneasy in the pocket on Sunday. Did you observe the same with Matt Ryan or no?
Certainly. And it's kind of weird because we've seen him perform well against pressure before. He has the ability to step up in the pocket and kind of maintain his throwing mechanics. And in this one, I think that you're right. It felt like he was skittish against pressure, and that really screwed up his footwork. And it was part of the reason his passes sailed. And absolutely. It felt like he thought there was going to be pressure on every play. He was kind of rewarded in that assumption and that there was a lot of pressure. You're right. There weren't any sacks, but the Vikings defensive line did a great job of making sure that it was impossible for Ryan to find any room in the pocket. And his response to that, it wasn't well managed. I mean, the one time he did try to scramble, he ran into Anthony Barr. The other times, he just kept on sailing passes high. So, the defensive line, I thought, did a really good job making him uncomfortable, and then he kind of exacerbated it by responding, I think, a little bit too much to that discomfort.
As you watched the game unfold, or maybe you've gone back and already watched the All-22, what else stood out to you? What were some of your major takeaways as to how the Vikings, outside of getting pressure on Matt Ryan, sort of stifled and slowed down that offense?
Well, I think, the defensive line in general obviously did a really good job, not just in pressure, but I thought they did a really good job shutting down runs. I know Devonta Freeman had 6.2 yards per attempt. A lot of it comes on these runs that kind of don't matter, on 2nd and 25 and 3rd and 20, they're going to give up like 7 or 8 yards on those. The longest run that Freeman had was 13 yards. I think that run was also a meaningless run. Don't remember quite exactly if that was the case, but they did a pretty good job making sure that they couldn't run to the outside. Everson Griffin was great at shutting down those outside runs. I don't think that he had a tackle for loss, but I think that he was pretty instrumental in the run game and making sure that running backs had to either pivot away or run to the sideline. So I wanted to bring that in, that they were a really good run defense despite sort of the yards per carry average in that game. And then beyond that, I thought Trey Waynes, Mackenzie Alexander, despite the pass interference, Terrence Newman, Harrison Smith, and Anderson Dale, they all had really excellent games, which is great because if your star cornerback is injured or struggling a little bit, you know, if everybody else is having a career game, it kind of doesn't matter. So I thought everybody there did a pretty good job. I thought Anthony Barr did a pretty good job. Defensively, it was just a really incredible performance from nearly everybody on the field.
He's a wealth of knowledge, and we always enjoy his time. Arif Hasan is with us this afternoon here on AM 1450 KATE. Is it somewhat noteworthy that the Vikings have shown they can win in a variety of ways? Does that matter at all in the grand scheme of things? Because it was a low-scoring game. They grinded it out, and they held down a Falcons offense that in the previous 3 weeks had put up some monster points. Now, again, one was against Tampa Bay, their defense not so good. One against Seattle, who was missing two-thirds of the Legion of Boom. But they went out and they executed nonetheless. The Vikings hold them to 9 points. But in previous weeks, they needed points against Detroit. The defense wasn't awful against the Lions, but it wasn't the normal defense we've been accustomed to seeing this year. Against Washington, they needed Case Keenum to make some plays. He had a couple bad picks, but the offense was stellar outside of that. Is it somewhat noteworthy that they can win in just about any way possible?
Yeah, for sure. And in this game, they certainly slowed things down. There were only 8 drives in the game. On average, an offense gets about 12 drives a game. And so the Vikings, you know, made sure that there were just it was going to be a low-scoring game simply by reducing the number of opportunities either team had by just draining the clock. And they did that throughout the game, not just near the end, where they did a really good job of choking out any possibility of a Falcons comeback. But I think that they kind of chose a low-scoring game, and they executed that. If it needed to be a high-scoring game, you know, I think they would have ramped up the pace. They would have called deeper passes in the second half. You know, what may come of that? Maybe Keenan would have been better in the second half. He's been a tale of two halves kind of guy. And so it may have worked out in a big way either way. But certainly, you know, this is a team that has shown that if it really does need to score quickly, it has the cojones to and the ability to, especially with the receivers that they have. They really did stop looking downfield after a certain point. Even when they were behind 9-7, they figured we're probably going to score a field goal or touchdown if we just stick to a conservative game plan, and that's exactly what they did. They punted really well. They kept the Falcons back, and so they were able to use a conservative game plan to get within touchdown scoring distance and at the top of the fourth, you know, throw a touchdown. So if they really had needed to, if the Falcons were kind of lighting up the defense, I think they would have quickened the pace and they would have kind of expanded their playbook to throw deeper. So this is a really flexible team, and I think that this is a good example of how, you know, they can win both styles of game, for sure.
Is Minnesota the best team in the NFC right now? Are you comfortable making that statement? Are you still holding out reservations?
I am comfortable making that statement, but I think that it is important to acknowledge that, you know, because the New Orleans team is a different team, that they're extremely good competitors. I think both the Rams and the Eagles are, I guess, a little bit more complete as teams, but both of them have shown that when they're up against opponents that are really good, they kind of falter. They don't play up to their own. Like, they do a good job putting away bad teams, but they don't kind of rise to the occasion when it comes to good teams. The Saints do that. The Vikings do that. And that puts the Vikings, I think, you know, well in a healthy spot when it comes to being sort of the best team in the NFC. And given the state of the AFC, maybe that means the Vikings are the best team in the NFL, which is, you know, a weird thing to say. It doesn't feel like that's true, but I think it's true.
Looking ahead, Carolina this week in another tough road contest for the Vikings. Let me ask you this first. More fearful for, not of, but for. Are you more fearful, Arif, for Cam Newton, knowing that Matt Khalil will be going up against Everson Griffin this weekend? Or are you more fearful for Russell Wilson, who knows his O-line is going to get destroyed by Jacksonville's front this weekend? Who are you more fearful for, Cam Newton or Russell Wilson?
Lord. I'm going to say more fearful for Cam Newton because Russell Wilson has done a really good job of avoiding hits, and Cam Newton invites them, both with his running style. I mean, they both run, but Wilson runs out of bounds. Cam runs into people. And then when there's pressure in the backfield, Cam you know, trusts his body to be able to take those hits, and sometimes he can kind of do the Roethlisberger where defenders kind of like fall off of him, and sometimes he can't. And Russell Wilson has no such illusions, and so he just gets away from people. And also, the last thing I was going to add is that in terms of converting pressure into sacks, you can kind of rank quarterbacks by how easily they prevent pressures from turning into sacks. Case Keenum is number one, which is great, but Russell Wilson's like number six. He's surprisingly few sacks for the amount of pressure that he gets. So, yeah, I think Cam Newton's at a greater risk.
Outside of the aforementioned potential matchup, Everson Griffin, Matt Khalil, what matchups are you most looking forward to Panthers-Vikings on Sunday?
I think the most important one is probably going to be Xavier Rhodes against Devin Funchess, because they don't have other receiving weapons unless, you know, Greg Olsen's foot has completely healed, and it didn't feel like it was last week. But, you know, Russell Shepard is bad, and so that matchup is going to determine the game. But I think maybe I'm most looking forward to, maybe I'm most looking forward to that one, too. There's nothing that strikes to me as, like, a sort of a marquee, super interesting matchup, unless maybe we're on the other side of the ball. But even then, I'm trying to think, and I can't come up with anything.
How do you like the Vikings' chances against Cam Newton in Carolina?
I think they're good. I think the weird thing is that we never really know kind of who the Panthers are or how good Cam Newton is going to be from week to week. They're a team with a winning record. I think they're 8-4.
Yep.
And so you have to respect them, but it really feels like every time I've watched the Panthers, it always feels like they're like either struggling or they're lights out. I mean, there were like 3 weeks where Cam Newton was back at his kind of his MVP form, and then he's not there anymore. And which one are we going to see? Because we've seen both this year. So I think the Vikings have a really good chance at winning. I think they've got sort of a better chance than they do of losing, but I think that there's like this weird volatility there. Well, we won't know which Cam Newton we have. So I've got a little bit of anxiousness about it, but not a ton.
We'll finish with our off notes, a couple to get to today. That Carson Wentz guy, he struggled on Sunday night against Seattle, huh?
Yeah, he had the good throw. People told me about the good throw. but, yeah, he had a really difficult game against Seattle. And I thought that was interesting because I thought Seattle was really going to have a difficult time without, you know, Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor. And it turns out they're still actually a good defense, and they still have the defensive player of the year. So, against a pretty good defense, Carson Wentz struggled. That's not entirely new, given sort of this year. I think they're 1-2 against teams with a winning record. They've had, I think, the third easiest schedule in the NFL by some measures. And so there's a little bit of potential fool's gold there. Not saying Carson Wentz isn't playing well overall. He did struggle a bit, and I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy that.
You just said defensive player of the year, talking about a Seattle Seahawk. You would give the award in that direction over someone like Aaron Donald. I know you're a big Aaron Donald guy, or someone like Calais Campbell, the year he's having in Jacksonville right now.
Yeah, I think Aaron Donald is the best player, but I think the most impact that we've seen is from Bobby Wagner. I think that he's had just an enormous impact, and he's been able to get to the ball better. He's been able, I think it's just like a production thing. I think that Donald is getting a ton of pressure. He's not finishing as much this year, and I think that's just like a variance thing. Like, some years you finish more, some years you don't. And I think that Wagner's done a better job of getting to the sideline. Of course, you know, Aaron Donald's a defensive tackle. It's difficult for him, but that means that Wagner's had kind of a bigger year. So Aaron Donald, better player. Bobby Wagner, I think, more impactful this year. So I'd give him Defensive Player of the Year. Calais Campbell, fantastic. You know, he's certainly in the conversation. He's helped a lot by Yannick Ngakoue, which, is great. I mean, he's forced 5 fumbles this year. Wagner, you know, a lot of people say he's helped a lot by the Seattle defense. I think he's what makes the Seattle defense around him better. I think that defensive line isn't as good as we thought it would be, you know, at the beginning of the season, especially after they traded for Sheldon Richardson. And Michael Bennett's not having a great year. I think, you know, Bobby Wagner, I'm not saying he's a one-man crew there. I mean, Jacksonville obviously has a bunch of people too. But I think that he's just been more individually impactful, and he's helped his teammates get better more than, say, Calais Campbell, who's also helped his teammates get better back in Jacksonville.
Ben McAdoo was fired yesterday. I'm curious who you think, which head coach in the NFL now, because it was clear that Ben McAdoo was sitting on the hottest of all hot seats for head coaches throughout the league. Who is that coach now that Ben McAdoo
has been fired? Which coach has the hottest of all seats?
Man,
I know Pagano is a popular name being thrown out there.
Yeah, Pagano's a good one. I was going to say, you know, we always kind of want to say John Fox, but it doesn't really feel like it anymore. I think he's going to get fired at the end of the season, but I don't think anyone's, like, rabid about it right now. So yeah, I guess Pagano, that one makes the most sense. I think Arians is probably going to leave on his own if some of the rumors are maybe true. I don't know. I don't know. I guess it would have to be Pagano.
What about, let me just throw a couple names out there. Hugh Jackson is one in Cleveland.
Right.
Like, do you think he comes back for a third year? Do you think they bring him back, whether they win a game or don't win any? Another one, Marvin Lewis, 15 years, I think, is Cleveland's or Cincinnati's head coach, and they've never won a playoff game. That's incredibly fascinating. And the third one is Todd Bowles is an interesting case because I think he's gotten a lot out of the New York Jets this year, and maybe that front office, maybe ownership wants to move on, but I think there's a chance that he is maybe staved off being fired for at least another year. Maybe he gets another contract. I don't know.
I think it would be a mistake for them to get rid of Todd Bowles. I think you're right. He's done a lot with the depleted Jets team. Yeah, I just never expect to see Marvin Lewis on a hot seat. If they get rid of him, it's probably a really good idea. Hugh Jackson, I think that there is a higher likelihood he stays than I think a lot of people will give him credit for. And I don't think it's necessarily a good thing if he stays. I think he's done a poor job. They should have at least won one game by now. And he's certainly on a hot seat. I think, you know, there's a good chance he does get fired. I just think that people are kind of overrating those chances because I think that the approach that they're taking with this front office now, I think they're a lot more patient than we're used to seeing out of Cleveland and Jimmy Haslam. And so I would say he has a hot seat. I'd say his seat is probably not as hot as Pagano's. Marvin Lewis, that would be super interesting. It would be really smart of, I think, Cincinnati to move on and to kind of indicate that they're going to create accountability. And that it's weird, but like Hugh Jackson and Mike Zimmer, and after that Paul Gunther, were clearly more critical to their success than Marvin Lewis, who after losing all three of those guys, it's done nothing.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Find his work, zonecoverage.com. His other work through the Daily Norseman, including his podcast. Thank you, as always, Arif.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll have the Jim Moore playoff segment next.